Good morning. We're going to call the Government Operations Committee meeting to order. Representative Tice, do you have a motion on the minutes?
So moved.
Representative Tice, move the minutes from our last meeting. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motions are adopted, or the minutes are adopted. Apologize, everyone, for the delay in starting the committee meeting. I have my word that will not happen again. First bill up, House File 329. As Representative Detmer comes down to the table, I will move that House File 329 be recommended to pass or referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee. Representative Detmer, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's good to be here with the rest of the committee. I just found out 5 minutes ago that I was here, so I don't know what happened, but we are here. And we have House File 329. If you remember last year, I had a constituent that came to me and was working for the prison and was injured on the job, was assaulted by an inmate. And through the process, he had lost his health insurance and was having a real problem. So we went forward and we were able to pass some legislation last year in his particular case to help him with insurance after being assaulted on the job and lost his health insurance. So I do have a Mr. Kolasowski. And he's going to be speaking to that to the 329 that was brought to me, and we'll turn it over to our guest.
Mr. Pajanski, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record, and we look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Richard Kajanski. I'm the Public Affairs and Communications Director for MAPE. And Representative Detmer did a great job explaining the purpose of this bill. Last session, many of you remember and voted in favor of a bill that passed unanimously by the Senate and the House. That provided employer-paid benefits to employees in correctional facilities that were in the general retirement plan. And it was reduced to that general retirement plan as an agreement with a former legislator to restrict the bill to kind of test the waters, if you will. This individual worked at the Stillwater Correctional Facility. He was assaulted by an offender. He was rendered totally and permanently disabled under Minnesota state statute. He had a metal plate in the back of his head, and he continues to suffer ailments today as a result. That injury on the job put him in financial hardship, as it would most individuals. I would draw your attention to the definition of totally and permanently disabled. It's in Minnesota Statute 176, and I'll just quickly kind of skim through it. And the definition is the total and permanent loss of the sight of both eyes, the loss of both arms at the shoulder, the loss of both legs so close to the hips that no effective artificial members can be used, any other injury which totally and permanently incapacitates the employee from working at an occupation which brings the employee an income. The employee has at least a 17% permanent partial disability rating of the whole body. The employee has a permanent partial disability rating of the whole body of at least 15% and is 50 years old or more, or the employee has a permanent partial disability rating of the whole body of at least 13% and is at least 55 years old at the time of the injury and has not completed grade 12 or obtained a GED. So it's an extremely high threshold, and that's what I draw your attention to. This legislation requires the Department of Corrections or the Department of Human Services to pay for the employer's share of insurance premiums for any employee who becomes totally and permanently disabled only as a result of an offender or patient assault. The employees at the security hospitals and correctional facilities would be the eligible employees. The payments would begin when an employee is determined to be totally and permanently disabled under this statute. And I would just, from experience, state that by the time the employee is actually certified to be totally and permanently disabled, they've endured almost 2 years of exhaustive medical appointments, surgeries, and so on. They've exhausted their workers' comp, vacation, sick leave, and their pay, and they're no longer employed at the state of Minnesota. Their situation is hardship. There's no other way to describe it. There's no retroactivity in this legislation this time around. Last year, the Department of Corrections estimated that up to two of their employees every 15 years would be eligible for this benefit. And last year, the governor specifically stated in a bill signing that he couldn't understand why all employees were not covered in that bill. And so I would just say that that may not have been a reference to the Department of Human Service employees that are now included this time around, but the employees that were specifically excluded last session, which were employees of the Department of Corrections that were covered under the Correctional Retirement Plan. And those employees generally include the corrections officers, caseworkers, some probation agents that are intensive agents out in the field, and there's a potpourri of a few other employees that are mixed in there as well. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure the status of the amendment that's before you, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kajewski. We don't currently have an amendment before us, Representative Detmer. We have a copy of an amendment here. Is that something you wish to try and handle in this committee?
Mr. Chair, members, I can speak to the amendment real briefly. The there was an error made in the bill, and it refers to all of the clients, if you will, in both the correctional facilities and the state security hospitals as inmates. The term in statute is patients, not inmates, and that's all this bill does is make an accurate reference to those individuals.
That'd be a technical amendment. So.
Okay. Representative Nelson, we're handing you a copy right now. It's a one-word technical amendment. Do you have any objections on moving this amendment to get the shape in the to get the bill in the shape that the author wishes? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't have an objection to it. Where is this bill going to from here?
It will be going to public safety and crime prevention.
Mr. Chair, because we didn't get the bills, you know, the kerfuffle we had at the beginning and this not being posted or so people could see it ahead of time, I think it might be better if he takes it with him to the next committee and does it. Because I realize it's only a one word and it's just a clarification of what the people are, but I think it might be better to do it there.
That's fine, Representative Nelson. We will pass on the amendment in this committee, and Representative Detmer, you can move this amendment at the next stop in public safety.
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, any questions to the bill before us? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Detmer. We currently have a plan for permanently disabled people in the Department of Corrections, but we're adding something under MSRS, and I don't understand why that is. What's the rationale there?
Mr. Kujewski.
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, last year the bill that passed included only employees of the Department of Corrections under the Correctional Retirement Plan. And so it really has no impact on the correctional MSRS plan, if you will, and I have a letter from Dave Bergstrom from last session stating that, that it was a way to narrow the focus of the bill, and that was at the request of former Representative Paymar, which I honored his request, and we worked to make sure that the individual who had encountered this hardship was being taken care of. And there's been many conversations with the Commissioner of Corrections, with former Representative Paymar, and in fact, even staff in the governor's office, that we were coming back with this bill next session.
So. Mr. Chair,
Representative
Runbeck. There's different group of employees under the MSRS Correctional, and who are those employees?
Mr. Kajewski.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the employees that are covered under the correctional plan are either in statute or determined to have a 75% contact amount of time contact with those inmates in the Department of Corrections. So that's how they're determined to be in that plan. There is a wide scope of employees. I think there's probably a few therapists out there. I'm looking over to my friends from DHS. They probably know better than I do. We have caseworkers that are in the correctional plan, the corrections officers, sergeants, lieutenants. I think maybe even the captains are in the correctional plan as well. There's a significant number of people that are covered, or a number of job classes as well that are covered in that plan.
Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up. So comparing the workers' comp system, I mean, I'm aware that it has provisions for people who are permanently disabled. And does anything of workers' comp apply to state employees in either of these plans?
Mr. Kujawski.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question, so you'll have to bear with me. The workers' comp covers these employees for a period of time, but by the time they become totally and permanently disabled to work, in the case of Mr. Campa, who was assaulted at the Stillwater Correctional Facility last session, and that bill, that was exhausted. And you're essentially relying on any long-term disability that you have, early retirement with the penalty and whatever Social Security disability would be your other form of income.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Kolodzowski, is that right? I wonder, though, if we could actually get some information on that. My understanding of workers' comp, that if you are permanently injured, mm-hmm. those benefits are for a lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Representative, that is not
Mr.
accurate.
Kujawski.
They're cut off.
Mr. Chair, last year my constituent that came forward and we took care with some legislation last year, he had exhausted his workman's comp. The family was starting to sell off things just to see if they could buy some insurance and so forth. So the last resort was coming to the legislature, and that's why we passed the legislation last year that we did. So this legislation hopefully will not allow somebody to fall through the cracks. And according to the Minnesota Association of Public Employees, that you might only have maybe two people that within a year that might fall under this piece of legislation.
Mr. Chair, members,
Mr. Kujawski,
I've been with MAPE for about 12 years, and the departments can speak better than I do. We only represent a certain number of employees in these agencies. We have right now, Mr. Campa is covered under the statute that was passed last year. I'm not aware of anybody in DHS that we represent that would be covered, even if it was retroactive 5-10 years ago at DHS. Maybe they would be. There have been people assaulted at the DHS facilities that are not in good shape, but I'm not sure they meet this criteria. We don't represent the person that I'm thinking of right now. So.
Representative Brumbach.
Chair, and I appreciate what you're trying to do here and so on. I just would like to get that information and really understand, because I'd be surprised, very surprised, if workers' comp isn't a lifetime benefit for seriously injured.
Mr. Chair. Representative Brumbach, we'll certainly get you some information on workers' comp. I think Representative O'Driscoll has a pretty solid background on this as well. I don't know if you're interested in speaking to this issue at all at this point, Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to kind of talk quickly and very briefly about the sequence of events. Most of the times what happens when an employee is injured in the line of work, whether it's law enforcement or corrections or elsewhere, you're required to carry Minnesota worker comp on the employees. There are benefits for medical, and there are also lost wage benefits. That does have a fixed amount of benefits that are paid, and that's why individuals would have health insurance are oftentimes encouraged to purchase long-term disability insurance. In the case of covered public employees, they may switch from active duty to a pension under one of the state pension plans. In this case, we're talking about MISRS for state correctional workers, or you would see that for PRA, police and fire, if an individual specifically was injured as a result of a covered law enforcement officer. So those benefits do have a finite amount of money and duration that they pay as an individual is determined to be able to either A, come back to work, or B, move to a permanent disability status and then draw a reduced pension, as was testified earlier today.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Nelson, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, to this point, the other piece of this that we're dealing with here, what this bill covers, is the health insurance for themselves and their families. Workers' compensation covers the cost, the medical cost of the injury and getting that employee back to their job, but it doesn't cover their, if they're not working, they don't have health insurance, so that doesn't cover their family, their wife, their kids, whatever, their dependents. It doesn't cover any of that other thing. So what this is doing is this person's permanently disabled, giving them, or a person that would this happen to in the future, giving them that health insurance coverage for the rest of their family because they're not able to work. And they that it was because of something that happened to them while they were working for us. And that's what this is about. And like I said, workers' comp, as Ms. Representative O'Driscoll said, there's a finite dollar amount and there's a finite time period by state laws where a person can collect that. And even if they're permanently disabled, when that runs out, they no longer get those workers' compensation. It does not go on forever.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Albright, to this point.
Representative Detmer and to your testifier, I'm just curious to what extent long-term disability coverage is currently provided, available, or administered currently by the group that this individual or in the larger context would be available to the prison employee population.
Mr. Kajewski.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, all state employees are permitted to purchase long-term disability coverage. I'm not certain. I'd have to get back to you on the capacity of what they're allowed. I see the Bruce. Do you know
how long they're
what percentage of their salary?
I believe it's 66 2/3%.
That would be the maximum.
Could you
for the record,
that,
Mr.
Yeah,
Chair,
thank you.
State employees are allowed to purchase up to 66 2/3% of their salary through long-term disability.
Representative Albright,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And what is the duration of that coverage? Is it to age 65? Is it for a 5-year benefit? Are they able to extend it and purchase it after the retirement or disability on their own? Can they extend that coverage personally after they terminate their employee and the employee-employer relationship? You can phone a friend.
Mr. Kajewski.
Mr. Chair, maybe Bruce Anderson can answer this.
Yeah. Excellent. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. If you would, please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bruce Anderson. I'm the acting director of the State Employee Group Insurance Program.
Proceed. Representative Albright, do you want to rephrase your question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, could you describe, maybe in kind of summary fashion, the availability of long-term disability coverage to employees?
Mr. Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. Long-term disability is a voluntary benefit that's offered to any state employee. As I mentioned earlier, they can purchase up to 66 2/3% of their salary. When they are determined to be disabled, they receive that benefit. I would need to get back to you with the duration or after they're no longer working if they're able to continue that benefit.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would also be helpful, the provisions of if it's an ONOC policy a provision or if it's a standard not able to perform the duties on your job description. I'm also curious to find out in terms of the level of participation. And the rationale for my line of questioning is to the point of whether or not it is a viable option for participants to utilize, or if it's, as some might suggest, a token response to what I would consider a highly volatile situation for employees. It may be that, you know, the risk that is undertaken by these people to underwrite it might be just terribly pervasive in terms of the premium that they might be looking at for the conditions that they serve in. So just the whole underwriting issue. So not to undermine the program or the work done, but just to go to the point of it may not be as beneficial for them to pick up that type of coverage as some might suggest based upon the environment that they work in.
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I gave you that information. With regard to the premium, it's a group policy, so it doesn't matter what occupation they are in for the state. So regardless of what job they have. The premium they pay is the same for anybody else.
Interesting. Representative Albright.
So then, Mr. Anderson, to that point, because it's a group coverage, when they terminate their employee, the relationship, then that coverage also de facto terminates as well. Do they have the opportunity to extend that coverage?
Mr. Anderson.
After their employment?
Mr. Chair and Representative, no, they do not have the opportunity to extend it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just trying to wrap my head around this a little bit. In my previous occupation, I toured a lot of the prisons in our state, and I know how dangerous that profession is. And what I'm hearing is basically this bill expands to cover the state hospitals as well. And we're trying to protect some of the professionals that are in those occupations that are some of the most dangerous that we have, and making sure that if they do get injured in the line of duty, that we're taking care of them. And you're saying the estimates are only two every 15 years?
Mr. Kajewski.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the Department of Corrections estimated last session that with all of their employees, this would apply to two people every 15, up to every 15 years.
Representative,
we haven't had an estimate from the Department of Human Services. And to be clear to this committee, I've met with the Department of Human Services, and we do have agreement, and going forward we will provide an amendment that defines the actual facilities, because it's going to have to be treated a little different than the Department of Corrections, because they have so many different entities. So it is for the security hospital in St. Peter and MSOP as well.
And this bill will be going to health finance as well along the way. So, Representative Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess to get back on the intent of the bill, I guess disability insurance, as we've been talking about here, covers the wage replacement, not the insurance. This is above and beyond that. What we're going here is saying we're not paying any wages. The bill is saying that the state will pick up the state's share, the employer's share of the insurance premium. The individuals would fall under this would then have to pick up the employee share of that, and so we're not providing wages. So the wage, you know, disability insurance that Representative Albrecht was asking about, that only recovers the wages that those person would get paid, not their insurance. And that's one thing that a lot of people don't understand is when you're injured, your health insurance stops, and this person here can't ever work again. He's totally disabled. At least the one that we passed it for last year. There's no way he's going to be able to pick up employer insurance anywhere else. So he's going to have to go and buy that on his own outside. So what this is saying is that this person is injured in the line of doing work, business, doing his job for the state of Minnesota, and he's totally permanently disabled, which is a high bar to get across, that we're going to pick up the employer's share of that health insurance so that this person and his family and his dependents going forward can have insurance. And they're not going to have, there's no wages involved in it. We're just picking up the insurance piece.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Detmer.
And Mr. Chair, you know, the reason why I'm bringing this forward this year, we went through it last year with one individual. Hopefully we wouldn't have to do it on a per case. We'll have it in statute, and we wouldn't have to come back to the legislature to serve another person maybe 15 years from now or next year or whatever. But this will cover what we intended to cover.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just one last comment. You know, the individual that I've heard from, and we don't even represent in St. Peter, for example, this has put them in financial hardship. They have a family. It's significant. Our members themselves are holding benefits for this family. They're on the verge of losing their home. This is a real financial hardship that we put these employees in when they're showing up at these places to work every day on behalf of all Minnesotans.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think to the point of Representative Nelson, the point of disability insurance is for income replacement. So to the extent of 66 2/3% or whatever amount is negotiated on a group basis, it is for income replacement. To the extent that the participant that is realizing that benefit utilizes it to pay bills, pay premiums, that type of thing, that's definitional. We're not arguing here in terms of whether or not this individual suffered substantial loss in the line of performing their duties. The line of questioning that I undertook was really more to the point of verifying whether or not that disability income protection program that is provided to employees is has the veracity that it could, but if it's not part of a collective bargaining agreement because of cost, then such as it is today, that's why Representative Detmer is bringing this forward. It might be more of a highlight in terms of what might be necessarily considered to be included in the next collective bargaining agreement that these people undertake. So thank you.
Any other member questions or comments? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question, Mr. Kolodzki. Could you just verify? I thought I heard you say that this plan would cover someone who had as little as 17% permanent disability. I believe you said that. And I just wonder sort of what kind of a disability is that, and is somebody at 17% unable to go back to work typically?
Mr. Kujawski.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the work comp statute 176.101, the definition is any other injury totally, this is one of the definitions I think you're referring to, any other injury which totally and permanently incapacitates the employee from working at an occupation which brings the employee an income, provided that the employee must also meet the criteria of one of the following items, and one of those items was the employee has at least a 17% permanent partial disability rating of the whole body. And maybe Representative O'Driscoll knows more than I do, but from what I've learned in handling this previously, 17% permanent partial disability rating is significant. It's very significant.
Well, Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Runbeck.
I guess it'd be helpful to know. I mean, it seems like that may not be the case.
Thank you, Representative. We will try and get you some information on that, but also this will be going to Health Finance where they will deal with that issue as well. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To put it in perspective then, the one gentleman that we covered last year that has a metal plate in his head, what was his rating and percentage?
Mr. Kujawski.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think his rating, and I'd have to double check with him, it was just, he didn't fall under that part of the definition, so I'd have to double check. He was above 50 years old, and so it would have fallen in a different part of the work comp statute, but it was right around the 20%. And he has traumatic brain injury for the rest of his life.
Thank you. Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify before the committee on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Detmer, any closing comments?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. You know, I'm looking forward to going to the next committee and present this, and hopefully this piece of legislation will cover people that are serving in our institutions and help them to continue as much as normal life as possible. So thank you.
Excellent. I will renew my motion that House File 329 be passed out of this committee and referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is prevailed. House File 329 is on its way to public safety. Thank you, Representative Detmer. Thank you, everyone, for the discussion on that bill. Now we're going to move on to a larger discussion surrounding constitutional amendments and how perhaps this body would like to deal with this issue, if we should deal with this issue. So we're going to just kind of start the discussion to see where the committee is at and, you know, perhaps, if anything, where we need to move. So with that, I'd like to ask Representative Johnson to come up to the committee. He's got a bill that would deal with this issue, and we would like to say welcome to the committee, and we look forward to hearing your ideas.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for hearing this. I want to take it back to 2012 or prior to that when the constitutional amendments were on the ballot. Please remember at that time I was very much a citizen of North Mankato. I had no intention of running for the legislature, so really what sparks this is more of my citizen legislator. And what I perceived at the time was that it sure seemed to me like the legislature was trying to circumvent the governor in presenting a couple of constitutional amendments because the governor didn't agree with that. And it felt to me like it was we were trying to legislate through constitutional amendment. Now, I want to be really careful and say I don't see this as a partisan issue. I think what comes around goes around. This could be whatever party's in that situation, I think, is vulnerable to this temptation. So in the idea of having the governor involved in the constitutional amendment process came was mentioned to me, I thought it was a good idea. And so, therefore, last session I did drop the bill. I didn't push it. You know, constitutional amendments are to be carefully dealt with, and I appreciate that a lot. But I wanted to keep the discussion going. So, therefore, yes, thank you very much for hearing the bill today because having an informational hearing on it because I think this is a solution. The idea of the bill is that to propose a constitutional amendment, both the House and the Senate would have to pass it. And then it just as with every other bill, it would go to the governor. The governor, if the governor signs the bill, the amendment would go on the ballot for the voters to consider it. If the governor chose to veto the bill, it would come back to the House and the Senate, just like it does now, and require a two-thirds majority to send it on to the ballot for the vote. I really see this as a solution to the House and the Senate working together to try and legislate without the governor's involvement. Furthermore, some would argue that indeed that is the process that is the Minnesota way, or that is embodied in the Constitution. And I refer to you to a law review article from the Hamlin Journal of Public Law and Policy of spring 2013, where the case is made that prior to, at least until the 1920s, that is the process that was done. That the bill would pass through the governor would sign it, and then it would move on to the ballot where there was a constitutional amendment. There are other proposals that suggest that we should just have still maintain what current practice of just the legislature working by asking for either a two-thirds vote or a 60% vote of the House and the Senate. My problem with that approach is that there are constitutional amendments that are very well merited. And so if you're having that high stakes, the two-thirds or the 60%, it may be hard to get that through the legislature. Even though, let's say, 59% of the legislature agrees and the governor agrees it's time to do it, it sets up an obstructionist approach again. And so it allows for somewhat, you know, of not being what I would call straightforward in the approach to the constitutional amendment. So I think this is a very reasonable solution, and I appreciate the committee considering it. I think it really makes much more straightforward the amendment process. It allows for amendments to proceed, but yet provides the governor is involved and kind of reduces what many citizens would call some game playing. And so thank you for considering the bill, and I'm open to your questions.
Thank you, Representative Johnson, for bringing this up. Certainly an interesting discussion. Do you know how long have we currently operated under the practice of majority House, majority Senate to get a constitutional amendment? Has the state always done it that way? What's your understanding?
My understanding is no, the state has not always done it that way. And it was, I believe, until the 1920s, and I'm referring to the article I read, the law review article, when actually the change was hinged upon largely some attorney general opinions that did not really fully reference the historical record, both in terms of what had been done, nor there was actually a case, the Sicombe, I don't know if I'm saying that right, and I appreciate I'm not a lawyer, so this challenges me as a citizen legislator. But the Sicombe versus Kittleson case, which was back in 1881, and it involved a kind of the territorial constitution was involved, and some questions about how the U.S. Constitution applies to that. But basically, in direct response to your question, it's been in the last 75 years or so that this has been applied.
Okay, Mr. Gehring, do you have any thoughts on that, or any additional information you could share with? I'm just curious. If you don't, that's fine.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I guess I need to see the law review article you're referencing. I'm not familiar with the 1920s change. I know the practice has been recently that the constitutional amendments are passed by the legislature in the form of a bill. They're presented to the governor as a matter of courtesy, but the governor's approval or veto doesn't have any legal effect over whether the amendment goes on the ballot. And so that might be something that happened in the 20s as well. But I, like I said, I need to read what he's referring to.
Interesting. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Representative Johnson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Mr. Gehring, I'll get you the law review article. In a way, the point, I think, is moot, because really there's a question. The question is raised by, you know, in the law review, but the point is we're confused. And if there's a legitimate discussion on that, this amendment serves to clear it up. And that's one of the values of it, I think, because there is, you know, it's clear in this law review article, there's a case to be made and there's confusion, and we don't want confusion on the process of putting a constitutional amendment before the people of Minnesota. And so that's another, I think, an argument in favor of the amendment, is let's clarify that so every citizen in Minnesota knows how it's done, and we can move forward from there.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Clark, I can see you're not a math major. Also, because it was in the 1920s, that's 94, 95 years, not 75. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
I have a social studies.
Anyway, the question I have: how does this compare to federal constitutional amendments? I believe the president's out of that loop. Also, how does this compare to that, and why should we do it differently in our state than we do it at the federal government?
Representative Johnson.
I believe you're correct, but I also believe that the Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I believe you're correct, but again, as I understand, the federal there's a 60% or a 66% threshold for passing the amendment through the House and the Senate, and the state constitution does not need to mimic the federal constitution, although there's a lot of precedent that works in that way. But with our 50% threshold, it's pretty easy to get an amendment on the ballot. And there, it's tempting for those in the majority in the legislature to do something that to take advantage of that situation. I still think that we could be well served by the 50%, as I stated, the 50% majority needed to move it along. But involving the governor, I think, is that check on it that's appropriate.
Representative Nelson, anything further? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative, used to be Clark, but I understand you changed your name to Johnson. Representative Johnson, on line 1.19 of your bill, it talks about gubernatorial approval of law, a law. I have first question of two is, would he then be construed as the final arbiter of every legislative action taken by this body?
Representative Johnson.
Representative Sanders, Representative Albright, members, if you read down, the it does allow for the veto and the overriding of the veto.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the representative, then, isn't that the case as it stands now in statute?
Representative Johnson.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I think in many ways this is the case that's being made by the folks in the law review article, and that is how we pass, by law, is how we pass law, is, as we all know, that's the House, the Senate, moves on to the governor. Governor either signs or not. If he does not sign, it comes back for an opportunity for a veto override. And the very point that's made in the law review article is that it is by law, and that's why it's a two word. The revisers wrote this for me, and that's why it's such a short bill, in that it just defines it as by law. And in many ways, that's the point I'm trying to make.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Johnson, to your point, we have a three-pronged governmental entity, with legislative, executive, and judicial. What would be the circumstance then by which a governor or anyone in the executive body could prevent any legislation from ever being passed, where would the citizens be provided an opportunity to override the voice of the governor?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, my first thought comes, it's in the election that comes up, is that that's where the citizens are involved. And I find it interesting that you're bringing up the citizens, because when you mention the three-pronged system of government we have, we also have the citizens out there. And I, now, granted, not part of the government, but my mind was actually wandering there. But it's the same as everything else. It would be in the next election, but in this case, the constitutional amendment, where it, to change the Constitution, I don't question at all the need for a citizen vote on a constitutional amendment, and that's just fundamental to how we operate. That's a tenet in the Constitution. I'm not questioning that a bit, but it's a matter of getting the amendment to the people, and so that's really that stays the same. But what I'm proposing here is changing the method by which the amendment gets on the ballot.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to belabor the point, but I think that you're tinkering with a system that has provided for every opportunity for each one of those three bodies, as well as the citizens, to interact with one another on a basis that has worked and served us well. I guess I take exception to the premise that there's vagueness or misunderstanding in terms of how to enact this law. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Albright. But I go back to my initial comments. I do believe that in 2012, it's certainly my perception as a citizen, that the governor was not involved. And so it did not proceed the way you explained it. I think this is a chance to kind of provide a break on a process moving too fast without the broader support in something that's pretty darn important in my mind, a constitutional amendment.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things I want to just visit on this. We're here today to discuss the concept, and I want to put it in more of a broader context. As was shared earlier and reviewed, we do have a three-branch government. The job of the executive branch, the governor's, is enforcement of laws. And the legislative, where we are members of, is the creation of laws. So it seems like there continues to keep, if we don't adopt this constitutional amendment idea, the delineation of powers that is intended in the Constitution. Moving that forward, a couple of other constitutional amendments that the state of Minnesota has put before the people to consider, referencing the ones that Representative Johnson has brought forward, the governor had done some ceremonial vetoing of those bills. So if the constituents in the state of Minnesota wanted to know where the governor was at, they certainly had an opportunity to see that through that ceremonial process. Last year, there was a constitutional amendment that was brought forward that some might say that this is also a legislating type of situation, where there was angst in the legislature about dealing with compensation for elected officials, dealing with compensation and the like for folks. And what we did is we said the legislature can't handle that. We have to let the governor handle that for the legislature by putting the governor, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and others to select a board. And there was some argument brought forward at that time that said that by de facto, the governor could appoint in a vacancy the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So the governor could actually run the table, if you will, against the legislature on that. That's about ready to go to the voters in 2016. So if I were a governor who wanted to preserve the powers of the governor's office, I couldn't wait to get a bill like that to my desk to sign and get that on the ballot, because it increases the power and shifts balance from the legislative branch to the office of the governor. Back in the 1980s, we also had a constitutional amendment that went on that allowed for an expansion of gaming in the state of Minnesota, specifically the lottery. And over that 25 or 30-year period of time, we have seen some creep within the boundaries of the lottery. and the legislature right now has considered and working its way through the legislature is some legislation to reform what was not specifically enumerated in the Constitution as benefits and types of gaming that the administration has said, not specifically Governor Dayton, because it has been an evolving process with many governors who have had that in front of them, that because it's not listed in the Constitution, it is something that the lottery could go ahead and engage in, and the legislature is looking to rein those kinds of things in under the Constitution as well. So if members do feel that this is important to move forward, I believe that it's more advocating by the legislature to the executive branch powers that are clearly delineated and preserved for the legislature.
Representative Johnson, any response?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll. Again, the powers that are delineated specifically to the legislature are in question. Also, you know, embedded in your comments, I think, are kind of particular circumstances to a particular governor, in that I don't think one can assume that a governor would have that same set of views necessarily, that one could imagine a scenario where it would be varied. And then thirdly, I think if we're having trouble, as you identify problems with past constitutional amendments, actually this amendment makes future constitutional amendments go through a longer or a more impactful deliberative process, which hopefully would in the future check some of the challenges that we've had with that we may have seen with past constitutional amendments.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, just to kind of follow up on Representative Johnson's comments, and again, I do thank you for bringing this forward for public discussion and debate. My comments are not directed at one governor. We've had the constitutional amendment in the books for almost 30 years, and so we've had Republican governors, we've had Democrat governors, we've had independent governors who have occupied the office of governor, and it just seems that there's been that creep that's been happening on that, so I share that. The other thing that we look at, you said that the duties reserved for the legislature are in question. If that was such an issue, and it has been in question, no one seems to have stepped forward to ask the Supreme Court in the state of Minnesota to, or take it through the judicial part of the three-prong process for clarification on that. So my assumption is that, number one, most people see that, or two, don't see it as an issue that the legislature is doing that because no one's brought it forward for litigation.
Looks like that's the end of members on the list. Representative Johnson, I'll give you the last word here in 30 seconds, but thank you very much for bringing the bill up for discussion.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I just want to say thank you. I find this to be an interesting topic. I do believe this is a very reasonable solution, and I ask you to deliberate about this and other solutions because, you know, I think it's in the interest of Minnesota, the future of Minnesota, to have a constitution that we can all be proud of and keep the politics out of that kind of business. So I this is my attempt to address that challenge. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. We appreciate the discussion. We certainly will continue the conversation. Thank you. Next, we'd like to bring up Representative Norton, who I see here, and she has a different approach on changing how we put an amendment on the ballot. And with that, thank you for taking the time to join us in this discussion, and we look forward to hearing your thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. First and foremost, I'm not an election expert. Like many of you in this committee, you're here because this is an issue that you spend a lot of time thinking and talking about. I brought this particular bill forward several years ago at the request of constituents on both sides of the aisle who were concerned that we did not have a high enough bar to bring constitutional amendments before voters. And so in discussion with lots of constituents, I came back to the Capitol, talked with research, did a little research on my own, and I must admit it's been a couple years since I read through all this. couple of the representatives actually have a lot more immediate knowledge of some of the history than I do. I did peruse it a couple years ago, and what I found in my study of other states is that the majority of states do things differently than we do. 35 states propose the constitutional amendment to be adopted during one session, which we do, but a supermajority vote is needed in 26 states, and we didn't have that here. And so, having served in the legislature and watched bills, bonding bills come forward needing that type of supermajority, it seemed to me the constitutional amendment rose to that level of importance, certainly, and perhaps even a higher level. And so I proceeded to have the two-thirds requirement drawn up in a bill, which I have filed last biennium and this one as well. And I would just note that in reading through some of the history, and I think I provided the group with kind of the history from the American Society of Legislative Clerks and Secretaries, and they just did an overview of many of the different laws across the country. I also, there's a House research document dated March 2012 that discusses the history. And in that history, starting as early as 1948, there were constitutional commissions that made recommendations to the legislature. And then in the very, one of the very first recommendations, the initial two were about what a majority of voters could pass an amendment, whether it was a majority of those who voted or a majority of those who voted on the amendment. That was debated early on, but amidst that discussion came the recommendation that the threshold for legislative approval should be at two-thirds. And so that started in 1948. It came back again years later, and we never took action on those committee recommendations. So I'm not an expert. It just seems to me that for many of the reasons I heard in a little bit of discussion from the proposal that came before me, which had a slightly different take on it, that this was reasonable. I would also say I was approached, and many of the rest of you may have been as well, from a group of attorneys who are studying this issue, and a couple years ago handed out documents about whether the governor had veto authority or not. And in fact, this group of attorneys who has reached this does believe that in current law, even though it's not been challenged, it's had an opinion written about it, but it hasn't been challenged in court. This group came before me and said that they thought the governor did have veto authority and we should write that in law. I guess my thinking with raising this to the two-thirds, it is that level. It is the two-thirds level, and so it kind of makes a moot point as to whether the governor needs to veto or not veto, because a two-thirds majority would be that level of support among both parties in both bodies. To me, it was unnecessary. And so this is the approach I've taken. I will open myself up for questions, although I need to tell you I've probably told you the extent of my knowledge on this issue. It is not because I am a studied election scholar. In fact, I've worked with the chair on an election issue, and I was even nervous in past years digging into that. I don't like to put my nose in where I'm not an expert. But I do, this is here because I do think we need to treat the Constitution with utmost respect, and that changes should be bicameral and bipartisan, and think this raises the bar to that level.
Excellent. Thank you, Representative Norton. I know you've had this for quite some time, so I appreciate you bringing it forward again. Certainly an excellent discussion for us to have. Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Rumbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's been a really interesting discussion. I kind of like the two-thirds idea myself. Looking back, I think we can think of at least three bills, recent bills that would not be on the ballot. What about the legacy? I don't remember how that passed the legislature. Would that have come as an amendment, a ballot question? Anybody remember?
Representative Norton, do you remember?
I don't.
Representative Mueller, you were here back then. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe it. I don't know if it took two-thirds, but it was a constitutional amendment. That's
yes.
So was
right.
Excellent.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I do.
Representative
recall,
Norton.
I do recall voting on the minority side of that particular.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious.
Sure. Any other member questions on this one, Representative O'Driscoll?
Well,
and just in the sense of being fair to both bills that are in front of us, I certainly like your preservation of keeping the legislative branch in control of those types of things. As I'm quickly scanning through the bill, my assumption is that, yes, each house of the legislature versus two-thirds total legislature.
Yes.
So seeing no further member questions, again, thank you, Representative Norton. Certainly a very valid idea that we'll continue to deliberate. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the committee.
Yep. Thank you for your time. Last on our agenda today, another approach in dealing with constitutional amendments, Representative Grunhagen. Welcome to the committee. And why don't you tell us a little bit about your ideas? We look forward to hearing your thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for having an informational meeting on HF 208. There is a companion bill in the Senate that's been introduced also. Basically, what the bill originated from, there was a Office of Legislative Audit, which you should have a copy of, on page 2 under conclusion and recommendations, kind of gives a summary as to what initiated the the action on this bill. The bill tries to address two things. In section 1, whether state officials should be able to advocate for or against a ballot question such as a constitutional amendment, and to what degree they can use public resources. In section 2, the bill tries to address more local ballot questions and to what degree public funds can be used to advocate for a ballot question. I have Mr. Nobles here to testify as to his report. I also would ask that Mr. Goldsmith from the Campaign Finance Committee would be allowed to testify secondly, as he has some concerns about Section 2. He says there's certain magic words, and I wouldn't want anything to be created that wasn't intended. And he does a good job. He stopped by my office and gave me the courtesy of explaining what his concerns were. And then there's several testifiers in the office to give brief testimony on specific examples as to why they believe this bill is necessary. There is an A1 amendment that I did not initiate. I found out about 3 minutes before the committee meeting. So I'm not going to address that. I will take time to visit with the author of that if the bill goes forward, but I'm not prepared to discuss that pro or con at today's informational meeting. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Nobles, which, by the way, I think does an excellent job, and I want this on the record, as the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And when you get reviewed for salary and benefit increases, you can use this tape, okay?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And I want to thank Representative Grunhagen for bringing this issue forward and for the discussion you've had this morning. I find this issue, in every respect that it's been discussed, really important and fascinating. The issue that came before the Office of Legislative Auditor is actually one that comes fairly frequently, and that is, have public resources been used appropriately in compliance with the law? And sometimes that question involves an elected official. And that always complicates things a little bit, quite a bit, because elected officials, constitutional officers in particular, that come under the jurisdiction and audit responsibility of the Office of Legislative Auditor, are elected officials that do engage in politics. They are elected to office. And even after they are in office, they're expected to take positions for and against different propositions. But the question that came up to me from Senator Newman and former Senator Perry was, is it within the law, is it appropriate for specifically the Secretary of State and then also the Commissioner of Human Rights to use public resources to advocate against the constitutional amendments that were on the ballot in 2012. My conclusion was that the law was not clear. And that, frankly, is sometimes the conclusion that I have to draw, because on a lot of these questions, there's kind of a gray area. And so I addressed some of those that I have looked at in the past in the memorandum, and I'll leave it for you to read. But clearly, there is a line that can be drawn, and you live in this world far more than I, and you know that there is a line that you are advised not to cross in use of public resources for certain kinds of activity. You certainly can use public resources, you do as legislators, as does the governor, other elected officials, to take positions, to advocate. But there does come a point when you are engaged in certain kinds of activities, political activities, where the standard is that you cannot use public resources. So you have to make decisions about using your stationery, your staff, for things that are appropriate to your office, and then things that cross the line are in the domain of a campaign. The question really is a campaign being carried on for or against a constitutional amendment the same as a campaign that you or the governor or the attorney general or secretary of state is conducting for their own office to get elected or reelected? And what I found is that there is some distinction, and it gets a little bit gray, and it's because there is a law that says public resources are not to be used for a personal interest. And one could argue that trying to get elected or reelected to an office is a personal interest. Obviously, you do it because you want to promote the public interest, but it is your particular interest to get elected or get reelected. It's a little more complicated when you take that personal interest away and you say the Secretary of State or the Commissioner of Human Rights or even the governor, other elected officials, are using public resources to campaign for or against the constitutional amendment. I found, again, that area to be rather gray, and so I wrote this memo to Senator Newman and suggested that this is something that the legislature ought to consider as a policy matter and that you ought to make it clear in law. There are some things that I think you really have to think seriously about. There are some real complexities and subtleties here. And just very quickly, one would be, do you want to make a distinction between certain public offices? For example, you could argue that the Secretary of State should be completely neutral on a question of a constitutional amendment because he or she is running the election system. A little wrinkle on that, which I presented to Senator Newman, and that would be, what if Senator Newman or Senator Kiffmeyer ran for Secretary of State very specifically saying, if you elect me, I will go to the legislature, advocate for a constitutional amendment that will require a photo ID. And if I'm elected Secretary of State, I will do everything within my power and use my office to protect the integrity of the electoral system. I will, in fact, use my office to ensure that that constitutional amendment is voted favorably by the voters. Now, when I put that question to Senator Newman, he, of course, opposed the current Secretary of State, Mark Ritchie, from using public resources because he was campaigning against a constitutional amendment that Senator Newman wanted enacted. So my point here is you just have to remember that this can cut either way. And in fact, the real question is the advocating for or against a constitutional amendment part of the official duties of that office? Is it appropriate and part of the duties of the Secretary of State to have a position and use public resources to promote it? And I raise that point because that's exactly what the Commissioner of Human Rights said when I asked him for documentation, did you use public resources to campaign against the two constitutional amendments, the photo ID and the marriage amendment? And he said, absolutely I did. It was part of my job. It was part of my responsibility as Commissioner of Human Rights. Those two constitutional amendments were violations of human rights. I did my job. I used public resources. I went out and advocated and told people to vote no. So, again, the point is there a difference between being Commissioner of Human Rights, being the Secretary of State, being the governor, or being a legislator? If this were to pass, you too would have to consider, where is the line for you as a legislator? You're involved in the legislative process. You obviously are going to take a position. You're going to vote for or against a proposed constitutional amendment. That's part of your job. But the issue is, once it's on the ballot, can you use your public resources, your stationery, your staff, whatever resources you have as an elected official, as a legislator, to say to your constituents and others in the state, vote against that constitutional amendment or vote for it? Because if we say it is wrong for the Secretary of State and make no exception, then you would confront that as well. So again, there are some real interesting, I think, policy questions. And when you come to drafting, it's going to take some fairly careful, precise drafting to draw this line. So thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. And again, thank you, Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, just a clarifying question, Mr. Nobles, is when you talk about as a legislator, when you use your own resources, that would be like things provided here at the SOB to conduct your business. But if I raised private funds to run for election, I could use my election stationery to promote or advocate for it. Is that clear?
Am I Mr. Nobles.
Absolutely. There are private monies and there are public monies involved in resources. And for example, the Secretary of State said when I asked, did you use public resources to campaign against the constitutional amendments? He said, no. I did not use any resources in my office that were appropriated, but you bet. I went out after hours in my own car on my own dollar, and I worked hard to defeat those amendments. Now, I think Representative Grunhagen and Senator Newman, I think, were concerned that even if the Secretary of State was using his private resources to campaign against, he was going out to town hall meetings and other places and using the prestige of his office. And that's another thing you have to consider, because when he went out and spoke as an off hours, he still was the Secretary of State saying these are bad amendments. So a lot of considerations you're going to have to make as you draw these lines.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nobles, you raise kind of a highlight the question that was on my mind in terms of, in the case of the Secretary of State, after hours, regardless of whether or not he's in a government-sanctioned vehicle or not, his own, when he walks into a room, two titles that precede him are, one, the position or the office for which he is a current resident, but secondarily, it's also the party to whom helped get him elected. And I'm just wondering, and I don't think there's a short and quick answer to this, but to what point does being elected to a statewide office, such as Secretary of State or Attorney General, specifically those two, require or obligate of the office holder to obligate themselves to act in an even more impartial manner than that would be predisposed by their party affiliation?
Mr. Nobles.
Representative Albright, that's a perennial question, and there are probably different points of view about that. I think there is an expectation, for example, you didn't mention the state auditor, an elected official, that the nature of that office is such that even though it is a partisan election that gets a person to be state auditor, that once state auditor, there is some expectation, probably a lot of expectation, that you leave the politics out of the audit function. Whether that then carries over to the Attorney General, people will differ. I personally think that it is very helpful for the credibility of opinions from the Office of the Attorney General for them to be as objective and nonpartisan as possible. I think many people would apply the same standard to the Secretary of State, because the primary function of that office is to run the elections in a completely neutral, nonpartisan way. I think when you come to the governor, there again may be a distinction. Is the governor ever anything but a partisan political figure? And so could there be an expectation that the governor not advocate for or against a constitutional amendment? You could still draw the line and say but you can't use public resources for that campaign. And again, that's often a tricky, somewhat gray area. We as an office just had to render an opinion on whether or not the governor violated the law in using the state-provided airplane as part of his campaign, and we said yes, he did.
Representative Albright, is that it for your line? Thank you. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the comments regarding the slippery slope that this may be teeing up is extremely concerning to me. And I think that in Mr. Noble's answer recent that he just gave, or explanation that he just gave, he talked about what we expect from our constitutional officers, and as he was making that explanation, it's clear to me that our constitutional officers stand for statewide election and are accountable to the people, and if they are in some way violating the expectation of their office, we have a pretty strong check in place regarding them having to stand for statewide elections. And the reason I say that is to underscore the fact that this, you know, they're not communicating to the public in any unfettered kind of fashion because they have to stand for election. Regarding the slippery slope, it brings all kinds of questions to me in terms of how I communicate to my constituents. And the questions that I get asked on a daily basis, we all get asked on a daily basis, how do you feel about this? Do you support this? Do you oppose it? At what point does this put our own free speech, essentially, in jeopardy with our constituents if we mail a letter on public and our official stationery, if we hold a meeting in our offices in the Capitol, which is official business. So I think that there are some real concerns with putting this forward in terms of how we would be able to communicate with the public.
Representative Lane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some comments here. I agree with Representative Halverson around our constituents ask us our question on email or in letter, and we respond, and we don't just say, sorry, I can't talk about that. We respond, and we are partisan in that way, and they want to know where we stand so they can choose how they're going to vote for us, and that's part of our everyday life. So we have to be careful we're not tying our hands. I do want to say that the Secretary of State, Mark Ritchie, when we were discussing those constitutional amendments, I was at more than one meeting where he was clear that I am telling you the facts of how this would work out if we went this direction. But I am not going to discuss this as a partisan issue. As soon as you are going to have any partisan discussion around it, you have to wait till I leave, because I'm not going to partake in any partisan discussion. I'm here to tell you how this would work out from the Secretary of State's point of view. And I thought he was very clear on that. And then a final comment, the school board people, they're not allowed to do more than put local school funds on a ballot issue other than the facts of that issue as a school board. However, as an individual, they're not tied. They can go out and they can say, yes, I'm for this. Please vote for it. But not the resources. They're still allowed to speak for their individual self, and you wouldn't want to stop that. I do know that one of the people you had on your list here to be here is, I don't see him in the audience, but he's been on the school board with me in a local area, and he was pushing for years that the superintendent and school board members should not be able to visit the legislature as school board people or superintendent, because that's using local district funds to advocate for the district, and that's more than he wanted to be able to spend local money on. So I thought that was taking it to a far extreme, but you have to advocate for that which you're a part of. We need to hear from school board people. We need to hear from superintendents how something affects them. And he would have put a stop to that, too, because that would be taking local funds to use for something that he saw as partisan view, although we would disagree on that. So there's just so many lines here that would have to be very carefully crafted, and I think it probably goes too far.
Mr. Nobles, I'm going to give you a chance to respond if you choose, but I just want to let everyone know we want to get Mr. Goldsmith up here, and we have a few private citizens as well that would like to talk, and we've got 16 minutes left. So just ask everyone to please keep the time in mind, because we will be ending at noon. Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman, I would just be very brief. I just want to make sure everybody understands. I'm not bringing forth a position as to what you ought to do. I just think as the legislative auditor, it's helpful when these questions arise, and they have arisen, they will continue to arise, as to whether or not somebody has inappropriately used public resources. What I need as a reference point is what you put into the law, which either authorizes or prohibits certain actions from occurring. So that's what I'm advocating for, is clarity in the law.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. And thank you very much for your time here, for all the work that you do. This committee holds your opinions in high regards, and you're welcome at any time. Representative Grunhagen will give you a quick word as we invite Mr. Goldsmith up to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just appreciate your comments about the time and the testifiers. I had testifiers come from some distance, so if they could make their testimony before we entertain any additional questions from committee members, I value those questions, but this is an informational meeting. We're not voting on it. And I just want to make sure they get a chance to, a couple minutes at least, to state their testimony.
Sure. Mr. Goldsmith, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board, and I'm here because Section 2 of the bill is proposed to be included in Chapter 10A of Minnesota Statutes, which is the chapter that the board administers. I don't think we'd object if you decided to put it in some other chapter. You have to consider that. This would put, then, the question of whether a public official has inappropriately used public money for the purpose of influencing a ballot question under the board's jurisdiction. And I know that the Office of the Legislative Auditor has some jurisdiction over general use of public money, so take care in considering where this particular provision goes. However, that's not the primary purpose of my being here. The primary purpose is to talk about how we administer laws, and I always want to comment when I see a problem in administering a law, should that law be passed. In his very carefully considered materials, Mr. Nobles noted a couple of things. In his conclusion, he said the law should try to clearly define the difference between providing neutral information and advocating support or opposition. And in his final comments, he said one of the things you could adopt would be a provision that made it inappropriate to use public money to advocate for or against a ballot question. He gives the examples of the Secretary of State and the Commissioner in the last election and some hypothetical conclusions as to what the public might decide based on some law that might be enacted. And he concludes by saying, however, both of those conclusions could be challenged. And I agree with that statement. I want to echo Mr. Noble's comments about how important it is when drafting these kinds of laws to either draft them clearly so that the agency that's going to enforce them knows what's expected, or to create a significant legislative record so that there is a record of the legislative intent to provide the agency with guidance going forward. And if this bill moves forward, or if this language is incorporated into some other bill, I will be here to help and to ask you to make a legislative record. To be more specific, the language of the bill prohibits the use of money, and I quote, with the purpose of promoting or defeating a ballot question. That's the first part. That language already appears in Chapter 10A. It's been litigated over the years, and it's primarily of importance when we talk about an agency or talk about a group who's not a political committee. It's an interest group, a nonprofit corporation, or maybe a commissioner or a constitutional officer. And when we talk about regulating speech by those groups, we have to be careful because their speech is often constitutionally protected. And in the case of promoting or defeating ballot questions or candidates, and these groups who are usually doing something else but jump into that purpose once in a while, the Supreme Court has said that this language is too vague. And two approaches have been developed over the years. The first one is to interpret statements like this for the purpose of, when applied to a communication, and to say that the communication has that purpose only if it uses words of express advocacy. These are the so-called magic words that came up in the Buckley versus Vallejo case. So one interpretation would be to look at this language and say it only applies to communications that say vote for or vote against this ballot question or enact or defeat this ballot question. A very narrow interpretation, but that was the first one that the courts developed. Because that interpretation was so narrow, the courts recognized that it allowed people to avoid regulation very readily by simply avoiding those magic words. And the court came up with the second basis on which this type of communication can constitutionally be regulated, and that is if it's the functional equivalent of express advocacy. And although you're not going to take up the A2 amendment, it's interesting to see it, or the A1 amendment, it's interesting to see it because on the first page, it shows you what you have already enacted with respect to independent expenditures, and that is you've enacted the magic words test, a communication that clearly identifies a candidate and uses words or phrases of express advocacy. The legislature has not enacted the functional equivalent test, which would also include in regulation a communication that no reasonable person could consider to be for any other purpose but to influence the outcome in the election. And so as it stands, this law is subject to interpretation by the agency. And at this point, we don't know whether you would expect us to interpret it narrowly to require a communication or to apply it only to communication that says vote for or against a ballot question, or whether more likely you would expect us to apply it more broadly to apply to any communication that couldn't really be for any other purpose than to influence the ballot question, but yet might not say specifically vote for it or vote against it. I have two final comments. The law also says it would apply to communication that in any manner has the effect of promoting or defeating a ballot question. The key words there are has the effect. The courts have made it quite clear that we cannot base regulation of speech on the effect of the speech because the speaker has no control over the effect of a speech on any particular listener. We would then need to go to listeners and say, how did you take this speech? So we have to eliminate anything but looking really at the four corners of the document, and we can determine purpose of a document by looking at what it says, but we can't determine the effect of that. And so in any form, that language should be removed. Finally, I want to make it clear that in Chapter 10A, ballot question is defined as a question that can be voted on by all of the voters in the state. So if this remains in Chapter 10A, that definition would apply, and this law would have no application to local races whatsoever, school board issues particularly. Also, I want to point out that public official is defined in Chapter 10A. This law applies to public officials, and that's another reason why this bill would have no application to local races, because typically local ballot questions have no public official involvement. And finally, the provision has no penalty, no civil penalty, or no remedy, although we have those types of provisions in Chapter 10A. And I point out that simply having a law that prohibits something is often effective. Laws are typically more effective if there is some sort of remedy for their violation, and that's lacking in this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Very good and interesting points for us to consider, Representative Grunhagen, as you move this bill forward. I'm going to invite up Ted Landwehr and Don Huizinga. If they can make their way forward. Representative Halverson, you had a question as they're making their way up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goldsmith referenced the A1 amendment, and if members could just take a look at that. I know that we're not going to be able to take it up today, but I think that this conversation is very germane to this amendment and what we're looking to do. There are clearly loopholes that you can drive a truck through in terms of what the public can understand about electioneering communication. And magic words really bother me because it's kind of like giving somebody a special key, and not everybody gets that special key. And I really believe that the public has a right to be able to analyze what we're doing with our election communication, and that's what everybody is doing, not just certain people who use certain words or hold certain offices. And so with that, I really would urge the chair and ask the chair if we're going to be able to hear this bill. I mean, essentially, I crafted it as an amendment, but this has been introduced as House File 43, would love to be able to bring this to committee so that we can have this discussion, because clearly the public wants it.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. I do anticipate having a discussion around language on this subject matter. Whether it's House File 43 or not remains to be determined, but this will be a discussion that we'll have, and I'll encourage you to work with others to make sure that we have legislation in front of us that's constitutional and has broad bipartisan support. So far in the past, House File 43 has only had bipartisan opposition. to the bill. So as we continue to work on this discussion, I encourage you to work with others across the side of the aisle, the Campaign Finance Board, to make sure that we do have a balanced, good discussion to make sure that we get it right the first time for Minnesota. Representative Halverson.
And Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I know that we have worked hard to take bills that maybe weren't in the shape that everybody around the table liked and brought together proposals that really worked for everybody. And I think if we can get this bill in front of committee, we can have that kind of discussion and make sure that everybody gets heard around the table. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Representative Grunhagen, to your testifiers, welcome both of you to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the records, and as best as you can, try and keep it to about 2 minutes.
I'm substituting for Ted Landwehr. My name is Eric Cardall. I'm an attorney and best known for representing citizens in lawsuits against the government. Probably have over 100 published cases. This laps into one of my subject areas, and that is campaign finance disclosure by school districts regarding expenses on campaigns. This is explicitly the use of taxpayer funds. And I've been litigating in about 7 or 8 cases through the Office of Administrative Hearings, and I have the same concerns Mr. Nobles has regarding the lack of clarity in the law. But one case has gone to the Minnesota Supreme Court, Abrahamson versus St. Louis County School District. We prevailed on the point against the school district bar that the school districts must report when they use taxpayer funds to campaign for ballot questions. But the Supreme Court punted on the question of whether it was illegal for the school district to use campaign funds. We came back to the Office of Administrative Hearings after the remand. This is after 3 years of litigation, and the school district refused to file a proper report. And now we have further litigation, even though they've been reprimanded by the Office of Administrative Hearings. Further, I've done litigation in St. Anthony School District, Robbinsdale, Howard Lake Waverly, Welcome Lake Memorial, Anoka Hennepin School District.
Representative Nelson, quickly to this point.
Point of information, my understanding is the 10A that that's here in this bill has nothing to do with it. We just heard the previous testifier, Mr. Goldsmith, say this has only deals with statewide implication, not local school local public officials like school districts, cities and that. And so I guess why are we hearing the testimony about something that's not in the bill?
Thank you, Representative Nelson. Technically, the language in front of us does deal with statewide ballot initiatives. If you could keep your comments closely to that, understand that there are some dovetails, but if you could keep as close to the bill and wrap up your comments briefly, we would appreciate
sure.
it.
And then with respect to the Secretary of State, the use of taxpayer funds with respect to his advocacy for online voter registration, the Ramsey County District Court issued a writ of quo warranto against the Secretary of State. And we never followed up with the misuse of funds when he was in an unauthorized position. But clearly, he was using taxpayer funds in violation of the law, as the Ramsey County District Court found, in order to push that law through the state legislature. And so these are the type of situations, and it's a statewide problem. And our concern principally is not so much the use of public funds, but what that means for opponents to the ballot questions. I mean, this is the sanctity of democracy with respect to how ballot questions are resolved. And when something is put on the ballot, it's sacred. And the government should stay out, and the yes groups, the no groups should advocate with their own funds. And I believe that's the spirit of this, and it's a statewide problem at state level of government and local government.
Thank you, Mr. Cardale. I would invite up to the testifiers table Ms. Susan Richardson. As Mr. Huizenga, you introduce yourself for the record.
Hi, my name is Don Huizenga. I'm a local citizen in District 11. And a lot of my comments actually were geared more in the arena of the school district and referendum levy promotion of those ballot initiatives. And being that the legislation proposed is outside of that realm, I'll just reserve all my comments at this point and then concede it to Mr. Cardall and Susan. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for being here. Ms. Richardson, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Susan Richardson, and I'm a taxpayer and a mother from South Washington County School Districts, and I am addressing school district issues. Is that...
We'll give you 30 seconds, but the bill deals with statewide ballot initiatives.
All right. Well, like most Minnesotans, I support prohibiting public officials from using public funds or resources to promote or defeat any ballot initiative. It is crucial that school districts stop using taxpayer dollars to assure a positive outcome for referendum campaigns. It leaves taxpayers and voters disadvantaged should they have an opposing viewpoint. And I will let you know this. We are two stay-at-home moms, and we pay $48 an hour to submit data requests to our school district in order to get this information out to you. And that's why I believe that this is very important. In 2013, South Washington County School Principal Julie Nielsen was pulled off her job at Middleton Elementary to aid the district in promoting the referendum. This necessitated the hiring of a substitute principal to fill her position. Therefore, taxpayers were funding both Ms. Nielsen, whose salary for 2013 was $186,000, and the substitute principal, whose salary remains a mystery.
Representative Nelson.
Point of information. It sounds like, number one, she's gone over her 30 seconds that you gave her. And number two, this is, again, it's not part of the bill. The local school districts have nothing to do with statewide ballot initiatives.
Thank you, Representative Nelson.
We have other people who had questions, and we're using up the time that could be used for members asking questions.
Ms. Richardson, we do have your written testimony in front of us. If you could conclude your remarks, we'd appreciate it.
In conclusion, I would like to say that taxpayers are being overburdened because we are spending money to support referendums and our children are being shortchanged. This year, we have an $8.5 million budget shortfall within our school district, and they are going to be cutting nursing staff, and they will be eliminating the music program in our elementary schools. This is a waste of our money that could be used elsewhere to support the education of our children.
Thank you, Ms. Richardson. Thank you for taking the time to come before the committee. I don't have any other members on the list. Representative Grunhagen will give you the final words right after Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had my hand up before. I guess I must have got passed over or not seen. I thought I was on the list. I guess the question I had with this, and number one, that I'm glad that the Representative Grunhagen did not include the legislature in the inherent prestige, because we know we're all not held in inherent prestige. Most of us are treated less than below car salesmen, used car salesmen.
But above the Senate.
Especially the Senate. Anyway, the question I have is, how does this, the White decision to having to deal, we used to restrict what people running for judge could say and advocate for or against. And again, like the Secretary of State and like the State Auditor, but when they're doing their job, we don't want them to have partisan rulings. But the White decision at the federal level, the Supreme Court said that we can't restrict what they can and can't say. And this, to me, seems to like it's going in going to that same direction as they're saying the Secretary of State can't do the advocate, the other people can't advocate. So I guess, how do you, Mr. Representative Grunhagen, how do you balance that in your mind, that because of this, to me, it looks like a clear violation of what the Supreme Court already ruled that we can and can't do.
Representative Grunhagen, if you could answer this and then also conclude your remarks.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Representative Nelson. Be glad to talk with you a little bit more offline about it. But obviously, this is an informational meeting. It's not an area where I consider myself a complete expert, so I was very interested to hear comments both from the existing public officials and from the committee in general. I think we've created that atmosphere of discussion with pros and cons, so I look forward to working on a bipartisan basis to improve the bill, address some of the concerns, and hopefully move forward on it in some fashion. Those are my concluding remarks also.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Thank you all for a great committee and good discussions today. Members, in your packet, everyone has a list of the bills that have been referred down to the subcommittee on the Met Council, which we'll be having a meeting on Thursday. With that, we are adjourned.